Hi, I'm Mike Dilk and you're listening to the Relax Back UK show, the show that explores all kinds of health topics relevant to you, your family and your friends. Each week I talk to expert guests from a range of backgrounds to inform and entertain you. So please do join the Relax Back UK family and stay tuned.
Hi, and thank you for joining me on the Relax Back UK show. Two guests this week. The first is gastroenterologist Dr. Alan Desmond. We talk about fibre in our diets, how to get it, and what it can do for us.
A healthy plant-centric or plant-based diet may reduce the risk of developing digestive cancers like colon cancer by up to 80%.
There's something very different, but also important for our health.
So it's really important to maintain a healthy social network, who you see in person on a regular basis, because then you get all the benefits of social interaction. You get all the lovely neurochemistry that comes alongside that. And that underpins your mental health, but also your physical health, because it underpins your immune system. So there's lots of research now showing how important social connectedness is.
Dr. Anna Machin is an evolutionary anthropologist, and we cover what we gossip about, our obsessions, and why gossip is good. So please do join me for a great show. Thank you. A couple of quick news items before the first guest. I have started an exercise program on my exercise bike. It's not too strenuous. You can join in. You can come and stream. I'm streaming the exercise sessions on YouTube. This is at 12:30 on Tuesdays, Thursdays and Fridays. Do come along. It's not too strenuous, at least not at the start. We'll see how it goes as time goes on. Also, UK Health Radio Awards is up and running. You can vote in many different categories, and you do that by going to ukhealthradio.com, clicking on the awards logo and scrolling through the categories. There are many of them, and you can vote in each one. There's even a category for presenter, so if you like the Relax Back UK show, you can vote for me. Now, on with my first guest. My first question to Dr. Alan Desmond was, what is fibre and why should we care?
Mike, that's such a great question. And, you know, as a gut health doctor, I think this is probably one of the most under-addressed topics. The reason we're on, of course, is because Linwood's Health Foods have commissioned this research among UK adults to find out about their gut health habits. And it turns out, Mike, that according to this survey, about two-thirds of us are really confused about what actually helps our gut health. So if there was one thing, I can give you a lot of other things too, and we can talk through that. But if there was one take-home message, one thing we can all do to improve our gut health is to correct fiber deficiency. So fiber is a group of complex carbohydrates and structural carbohydrates that we can only get in our diet by eating more plants. Fiber-rich foods, traditional foods like fruits, vegetables, beans, lentils, whole grains, nuts and seeds, these all contain a variety of different kinds of dietary fiber. In the UK right now, and in most high-income countries where the standard Western diet has become the norm, most of our calories come from highly processed foods, junk foods, meat and fat.
We'll come on to kind of why this is happening and what we can do to kind of put it right. But
the important thing being, those are zero fiber foods very often, Mike. So that gives us a close to zero fiber diet for many people, which is the perfect recipe for terrible gut health.
So what could be the result of that? You know, gut health, what is the result? And also, are there any other sort of nasty surprises that might come about? Any other diseases that we might be more likely to get?
Well, we know that, on a daily basis, I get out of bed in the morning, Mike, and I think to myself, what kind of gut microbiome am I building today? And thinking about that every day is like a really, it's like a nice touchstone for your gut health.
I would suggest you're in a minority. With that being your first thought?
In fact, this survey that we're discussing today showed that about 20% of people are thinking about their gut health each day, or at least in the survey they claimed to be. So they're trying to be gut health conscious. They're gut health carers. And I would like more people to be like that. Because if we're eating the standard Western diet on a day-to-day basis, we are consuming foods that help to push our gut microbiome in an unhealthy direction. Now, why is that important? Well, inside every single one of us.
What's going to happen to us if we're not doing this? Yeah.
Well, we're building a gut microbiome. We've these hundreds of trillions of microbes in our gut microbiome that have been described as a control center for human biology. Our healthy gut microbiome helps control our body weight. It helps to reduce chronic inflammation in our body. It helps to reduce our risk of even developing digestive cancers. By building a healthy gut microbiome, we're optimizing our digestion for better gut health, not just today, but well into the future. We know that people who eat a healthy plant-centric diet, who are getting more, much more than the minimum recommended 30 grams of dietary fiber per day, are at substantially lower risk of developing multiple serious gastrointestinal problems, up to 70% less likely to get diverticular disease, maybe 50% less likely to get gallstones. And a healthy plant-centric or plant-based diet may reduce the risk of developing digestive cancers like colon cancer by up to 80%. So there's a lot of benefits on offer.
So these things sound very dramatic, you know, these high percentages you've given, 80%. But I must admit, this is leading up to an impossible question, by the way. So I'll carry on. But percentages alarm me because 80% sounds like a massive increase. But, you know, if the increase is from 10 to 18, you know,
sure.
It's not. So can you stick some numbers on those so I can understand,
let's really understand
what we're talking about?
Well, when we're talking about public health messaging, we need to look at the big picture. It is useful to think of our individual health, but we also need to look beyond that, the health of the society and the country we live in. So, for example, Mike, in the UK right now, 45,000 people are diagnosed with bowel cancer every single year. Colorectal cancer, it's one of our leading cancers. It's the reason why we have a bowel cancer screening program. It's so common, we want people to get checked early.
I've done that. I've been sent the little thing, stuck my poo in it, sent it home, sent it back.
Good on you. I'm very involved in bowel cancer screening, so thank you for taking part. And let's publicize that. When you get the invitation, when you hit 50 right now, please take part. It's so important. And the reason it's so important is because 45,000 people in the UK right now are diagnosed with colon cancer every single year. Even if it's found at an early stage, which is where we want to be, and that's why we have the bowel cancer screening program, obviously a cancer diagnosis, Mike, can have devastating consequences. You know, even with a very early cancer, you may still be looking at surgery. You may be looking at years of uncertainty where you're having those follow-up scans and checkups, okay? We know that a healthy diet and lifestyle could reduce rates of bowel cancer in the UK by between 50 and 80%. So that's tens of thousands of people who would be living without a bowel cancer diagnosis. We know, for example, that red meat and processed meat, so your bacon, your sausages, your lamb, your beef burgers, are probably responsible for about 9,000 cases of bowel cancer in the UK every year. So if we can share this information broadly, and I know that, you know, through your platform, you are reaching hundreds of thousands of people. If we can share this information with people right now, today, we can actually help to prevent possibly thousands, if not tens of thousands, of cases of cancer in 10, 20, or 30 years. So that statistics should impress anyone.
That is perfect. That's actually exactly the answer I was after. And I was kind of thinking, I wonder if he's going to know this, but you knew them off the top of your head. So that's perfect. Thank you very much indeed. Great answer. So essentially, we're saying this is a lot more serious than just being, you know, been a bit constipated or a bit bloated or a bit uncomfortable occasionally.
So, I mean, healthy digestion is part, an integral part of being a healthy human being. If you think about it, I mean, the most basic function of our digestive system is to take the food we eat and turn it into building blocks for our human body. So when we eat food, whether it's healthy or unhealthy, our incredible digestive system has to get to work and extract the proteins, the fats, the carbohydrates, the vitamins, the minerals, the antioxidants, the phytonutrients that we get from healthy foods, and has to use these building blocks to build muscle and skin and repair the lining of our gut. So these are the building blocks of a healthy human body. Did you know, Mike, that every morning when you get out of bed, about 90 grams of your human body is brand new? So every day there's 90 grams brand new you. and your body needs material. And that's where food comes in. Food is fuel. It's so important. But of course, we know that, you know, Hippocrates, more than 2,500 years ago, said that all disease begins in the gut. I like to put a positive spin on that. With all due respect to Hippocrates, all health begins in the gut. And modern science backs this up. In the 21st century, we, of course, understand that good gut health isn't just about digestion and regular bowel movements and avoiding bloating, although those things are important. Having excellent gut health also increases our risks of having good energy levels, stronger immunity, better blood sugar control, better appetite control, reduces a risk of multiple chronic diseases. So some signals that you might experience telling you that things are not well some signals that your body sends you to let you know that things are going well in terms of your gut health would include, you know, good appetite, regular comfortable digestion, regular bowel movements, steady energy, undisturbed sleep. These are all actual good indicators of good gut health.
Okay, right. So to help us make sure that happens, fiber is one thing that we have to get enough of. So how much fiber do we actually kind of need to eat a day?
Okay, the recommended minimum intake for an adult is about 30 grams of dietary fiber. So in order to reach that number, we need to be fiber conscious. We need to be fiber aware every time we eat. Now, this is a conversation I will have with new patients at my clinic all the time. As I mentioned earlier, thanks to the heavy marketing of the standard Western diet, many people are not fiber aware. It's not something they're thinking about each time they eat. But I'm going to give you three questions that I ask every new patient, and anyone can answer these three questions. Okay.
I thought I was asking the questions, but carry on.
Well, I'm turning the mic on you now. So
that's fine.
Mic on the mic. How many pieces of fruit do you eat every day? An apple, a banana, or a small bowl of berries counts as one serving?
Yeah, I would say average, probably about a half.
About a half. Okay. How many servings of vegetables do you have per day? Now, a serving of vegetables would be like 2 heaped tablespoons of cooked vegetables or a small bowl of salad.
Yeah. No, I'm up there. I'm pretty good on that. I'm probably very close to the 5 that it's suggested.
Okay, cool. Okay, excellent. Okay. How many servings of whole grains do you have every day? Now, a serving of whole grains would be a slice of wholemeal bread or 2 heaped tablespoons of cooked brown rice, oats, or whole wheat pasta.
I probably do on the bread. I probably have 4 or 5 slices of wholemeal bread a day.
Excellent.
The other stuff, not so much, actually.
Well, that's okay, because you're already winning, okay? Because just based on that very quick question, how many pieces of fruit a day, how many servings of vegetables per day, how many servings of whole grains per day, you're scoring a 10. So your servings add up to 10. And if a person adds up their servings for each of those simple 3 questions, and the answer is 9 or more, then that indicates that they're probably reaching the minimum required of 30 grams of dietary fiber per day. But that just shows you how fiber aware you need to be. So your answers indicate that you are fiber aware and that you are probably consuming a bit more than the recommended minimum. But you asked me at the start of this question, what is the ideal amount of dietary fiber to consume? So in the 1950s, Dr. Dennis Burkitt, the doctor who put the word fiber into medical textbooks, because he published a landmark paper back in 1972 identifying that many of the chronic illnesses that we deal with in high-income countries are actually diseases that are intricately linked to fiber deficiency. That wasn't something that was on the scientific radar up to then.
Ancient history, is it really? I mean, this is relatively recent.
This is in 1971 he published his landmark paper on diseases of Western civilization, is what he called the paper back then. But he had suggested that a dietary intake of dietary fiber of about 50 to 60 grams of fiber per day was optimal for human health. And in fact, the research in the 21st century continues to validate Dr. Burkitt's theories. And if I was going to give you a number, and of course, everybody is different, I would currently, based on what we know in September of 2025, I would think about 20 grams of dietary fiber per 1,000 calories consumed. So for an average 70-kilogram adult male, for example, who's aiming for about 2,500 calories per day, they should be aiming for about 50 grams of dietary fiber per day. And if they're falling really short of that, taking gradual steps to reach that number is a really smart thing to do. And, you know, I just gave you a very quick dietary survey. If you really want to get into the nitty-gritty, you could download a free diet tracking app like MyFitnessPal or NutritionX. Use that for just a few days. I don't want people to get obsessed with this, and just to track their intakes for a few days.
Perhaps I can just ask a very sort of simple question. So when you're asking me these questions, there was a large range of foodstuffs that you were asking me about if I ate them, and they contain fiber. You know, so there's loads of stuff with fiber in that people can eat. So what's the problem? You know, why aren't people eating it? Is it just in stuff that people generally don't like, or, you know, what's going on?
Well, it's interesting because although personal choice certainly comes into it, of course, personal choice does come into it. But I think the bigger drivers here, number one, are lack of education. And that's nobody's fault. It's like people are not getting taught this in schools or in their general life. We're not really talking about the healthy foods that help to build a healthy gut and a healthy body on a day-to-day basis. I wish that this was part of the mandatory curriculum in primary schools, secondary schools, universities, and beyond. Anywhere where people are educated, we should be talking about dietary fiber, fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, nuts, and seeds, and the overriding gut health benefits and general health benefits of a plant-centric diet that is built from these foods that have been nourishing humans for millennia. That's the first thing. Lack of knowledge. It's not anyone's fault. We're just not talking about this in our educational system. And of course, the second item is that, or the second reason is that the food that we consume has got very little to do with personal choice. Because when we go into food stores, shops, convenience stores, and even supermarkets, most of the food that is there for one reason: to generate profit for the people who are selling it. And so the food industry overall, by and large, and of course, there are great exceptions, including Linwood's Health Foods, the people who commissioned the survey that prompted our discussion today. But most
they're a charity, are they then?
Linwood's Health Foods, no, they're a wonderful Irish company that are absolutely conscientious about producing really healthy
foods. I knew they weren't a charity.
Foods.
That was a bit tongue-in-cheek, Alan.
Oh, that's okay. No, they're not a charity, but they're. But I've been a fan of their products for years. My wife and I have had Linwood's flax seeds in our kitchen for years and years and years. So when they reached out to me as a gut health doctor and said, "Hey, we'd like to work with you a little bit," it made complete sense. So, you know, so a very decent company and a family company too, just a nice small family company who were really helping to make healthy habits a simple daily choice. But the most of the companies aren't interested in helping their customers to be healthier. They just want food that is cheap to produce, shelf stable, and dangerously addictive, and will appeal to our basic monkey minds and help us, you know, just feed us a diet of highly processed sugar, fat, salt. Well,
yeah, we're talking UPF
nothing
here.
To do with health.
Ultra-processed foods is definitely an issue. And that's probably a whole nother series that I might have to invite you back to talk about.
That would be lovely.
So, but let me ask. So are you a vegetarian then, Alan?
So personally, I choose to build every single meal from fiber-containing foods. So I don't eat any animal products, any dairy, and I don't eat any unhealthy processed foods if I can avoid them.
So would you suggest for intake of fiber, and maybe other reasons as well, that being a vegetarian is a good way to go, or maybe having 2 or 3 days a week where you're vegetarian, something like that?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, in many ways, the label doesn't matter, okay? So eating a gut-healthy diet isn't about labeling yourself as vegan, vegetarian, omnivorous, or flexitarian. It's about choosing to build most of your meals or all of your meals from these foods that nourish a healthy gut microbiome and support good gut health. It just so happens, Mike, that those foods are fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, nuts and seeds, and leafy greens, herbs and spices. So these are all available to someone who wants to eat a healthy, plant-centric diet. But because people who are vegan or vegetarian tend to eat more of those foods, far fewer animal products, less dairy or no dairy. It's no surprise that study after study is showing us that vegans and vegetarians tend to have a healthier gut microbiome. So a great paper published by Tim Spector and his team earlier this year looked at healthfulness of dietary intakes, but also the healthiness of the gut microbiome. And they also asked their volunteers whether they were vegan, vegetarian or omnivorous. Now, we can assume that everyone who took part in the study was pretty health conscious anyway, because they're taking part in this gut microbiome research. There's a little bit of a selection bias there. But even in that group, they showed that these three different groups, vegan, vegetarian, omnivorous, had distinct microbiome patterns. Vegans tended to have the healthiest gut microbiome, then vegetarians, and then omnivores. In that paper, they did a really interesting analysis called an area under the curve analysis, if you're familiar with that. So they basically trained a computer to try and identify whether people were vegan, vegetarian, or omnivorous just based on the health of the gut microbiome. The area under the curve was 85%, which means that statistically, the computer model could tell whether someone was vegan or vegetarian or omnivorous based on the healthiness of the gut microbiome 85% of the time.
I can hear my physics teacher doing a number of revolutions per minute in his grave. An area under a curve is not going to be a percentage. It's going to be an area.
Excuse me, it's 0.85. So the area under the curve was 0.85. Which showed that the computer
model
was
an area of some sort. I would
an
have thought.
Area under the curve, yeah. So AUC was 0.85. So so that tells us that these three different dietary groups have different gut microbiome signatures. But it is true that within the omnivorous group, there were some people whose gut microbiomes were really healthy. And how did they do it? Well, they did it by maximizing their healthy plant-based dietary index, focusing their meals on fruits, vegetables, legumes, whole grains, legumes, nuts and seeds, and really minimizing the ultra-processed food, the dairy and the meat. So really, it's about healthy whole food plant-based meals and allowing all of those healthy foods to push the other stuff to the side of the plate.
Right, we've spoken a lot about good things to eat. What about just quickly looking or just focusing on maybe a couple of things we shouldn't eat or drink or reduce maybe? And I'm specifically thinking, well, actually, coffee is one of the things I'm thinking of, because a lot of us really
love
coffee.
I've got
coffee.
A cup of coffee right here, so let's talk about it.
Yeah.
Okay, coffee. Okay, so several studies have shown that coffee consumers actually get some gut health benefits, both in their gut microbiome with increased gut microbiome diversity, but also in their digestive health with reduced rates of colon cancer and liver cancer. And probably, Mike, the reason for that is we think of coffee as just being caffeine, but of course, it's a plant-derived brew. It's rich with antioxidants, polyphenols, soluble fiber. Even coffee contains some soluble fiber. So there's a lot of stuff in coffee that should be beneficial to our diet, and the science supports that. However, some people are more prone to the jittery side effects of the caffeine, which can cause a little bit of nausea, a little bit of acid reflux, and sometimes send them rushing to the bathroom. So if you're one of those people, then minimizing your coffee intake to maybe one or two cups per day or switching to a good quality decaf will mean that you're getting all of those gut health benefits, but you're not getting any of the jittery side effects. But even so, if you don't enjoy coffee, then why not turn to a nice cup of tea or a healthy herbal tea or a green tea, which all have their own individual gut health benefits as well. But I guess the headline news for coffee is it's actually got a clean bill of health. There was a cover on the British Medical Journal several years ago when they performed a huge umbrella review of coffee and health. And I remember the cover of that issue of the BMJ dearly, because a picture of a big cup of coffee. And it said, coffee gets a clean bill of health. Because, of course, for years, we always thought about coffee as being that kind of type A personality, high blood pressure, working hard, not getting enough sleep, drinking black coffee. But actually, within a healthy diet and lifestyle, there's definitely a place for coffee if you enjoy it.
Good. I absolutely love coffee. So I'm very glad to hear that.
Can I declare a bias? But the science backs us up.
Yeah. Now, you've spoken about how many people are really not getting enough fiber. That's been the main focus of the chat. Now, so I'm wondering if kind of all the people that sell vitamins and supplements and all that are viewing this and rubbing their hands together as a marvellous opportunity to peddle some more of their wares. Now, my thought probably, because, you know, fibre's a bit different, you can't get it in a pill. You have to have it in food. Is that correct?
No, that's not true. I mean, there are various ways that you can isolate both soluble and insoluble fiber and market it and package it and sell it. And those can be helpful. I think I do see patients at my clinic who've got very extreme gut health problems, and building their dietary fiber is going to be a challenge for them for various technical reasons. And then sometimes just giving them a small dose of a pure insoluble fiber supplement can be helpful. But I would say, Mike, for the vast majority of people, look, you know, this survey by Linwood's showed that about two-thirds of us are really confused about what actually helps our gut health. And I'm not surprised by this gut health confusion, whether that's about fiber or anything else to do with gut health, because there's so much marketing of so many products, probiotics, magic pills and magic bullets for gut health. The science-based answers, the key to gut health are, I mean, these things are pretty simple. They shouldn't cost a ton of money, and it's about building a gut-healthy diet and lifestyle. There are several areas that you can work on a day-to-day basis for zero money or close to no money that will be far more powerful than any probiotic pill or potion, that's for sure.
Okay, that's a very, very good answer. Thank you. And actually, probably a good place to finish. So that the final question would be, you say people are sort of generally confused because they're bombarded with information that might come from conflicting places. A good information source, a good resource, whether that be the NHS website or whatever, what is, you know, a good source that you can suggest?
Okay, well, Mike, I'm pretty active on social media. If people want to look for me, Dr. Alan Desmond on Instagram, I'm always sharing free videos about the latest research and healthy hacks to help build a healthier diet and a healthier gut. I'm also an ambassador for Plant-Based Health Professionals UK. So that's a not-for-profit organization that helps to educate the public, policymakers and our fellow health professionals on the benefits of a plant-centric diet. And you can learn more about plant-based health professionals UK at pbhp.uk, or just search online for plant-based health professionals UK. And you'll find all sorts of resources, not just about gut health, but about heart health, overall health, endocrine health, heart disease, diverticular disease, planning a healthy pregnancy, all within the structure of a healthy diet and lifestyle.
Excellent. Alan, thank you so much for taking the time to chat. Really interesting stuff. Very useful stuff as well. So many, many thanks.
Well, thanks, Mike. And thanks for putting a spotlight on gut health. You know, just a final note. This survey also showed that about 30% of people are too embarrassed to talk to their doctor about their gut health concerns. So please remember, everybody, that we all eat food. We all chew, swallow, burp, fart and poop. Do not be embarrassed. And if you do have any concerns, just pick up the phone, make that appointment to go and have a chat with your doctor, get checked out and make sure there's no serious problems there, you know?
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
If optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one super supplement brand, help you achieve that in the most convenient and comprehensive way possible. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, sleep, emotional balance, and more. Benefit from the power, purity, and positivity of our award-winning powder sachets or our therapeutic capsule range. Use code RADIO15 at reviveactive.com and save 15% off today. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
the station that makes you feel good.
My next guest is evolutionary anthropologist Dr. Anna Machin, and the topic is what we might gossip about and our obsessions. My first question was, is what we gossip about at the pub, on the street corner, that sort of thing, is that actually the same as our obsessions?
It can be. Well, this is really a top 30 obsession. So what are the things that you're most likely to talk about, the most you're most likely to think about, the things that you sort of feel are part of your identity, I suppose?
Because I'd say
it's not just what it's not just what we talk about. It's what we, you know, spend our time focusing on, really. So it was carried out over 2000 people by Jason Saudo. And the idea was to come up with, what were the top 30 things that the British public obsess about, really?
Okay, because they might not talk about their obsessions. They might keep their obsessions quiet and they might talk about other things. You never know.
Yes, absolutely. That's true. And so, as I said, this might be something, this is why, these are the ones we admit to, and also the ones, I mean, it's not necessarily to talk about. It might be that just something that you dwell on and think about.
Sure. All right. Well, there are plenty of them, so we can't go through them all. But let's maybe concentrate on the top five. What are the top five?
Okay, so the top five is royal family is the first one at 53%. Then we've got weather.
Really?
Weather at 50%.
I'm pretty normal, I think. I don't spend any time thinking, really, or talking about the royal family and a lot of people in my world.
Yeah, it's just over half of the people who were surveyed talk about the royal family. I mean, we don't know in what context they talk about the royal family. It could be positive, it could be negative, we don't know. But it's certainly something that sits at the foremost of some people's minds, absolutely.
Right. Number two?
Is the weather, which is not surprising, really. 50% of people obsess over the British weather. And I think that's probably because it controls so much of our lives, as in what we can do, what we can't do, what plans we're able to make. So,
well, this morning I was doing some painting. I was painting some windows, outside of windows. So the weather matters doing that sort of thing. So, yeah, I was definitely talking about the weather this morning. So I'm a tick for number two.
The third one is the pub, 49%.
Talking about the pub.
Well, talking about the pub, what your favourite pub is, meeting up at the pub, all these sorts of things. The pub is still central to British life by the sounds of it, even though there's obviously been lots of reports about they're closing at a startling rate, but we still see them very much as being integral to our lives.
Yeah, I love pubs. Well, I don't go there as much as I would like, but I love pubs.
Absolutely.
So I get that. All right, next one.
Yeah, number four is tea, 42%. So we obsess over tea, and particularly the best way to make a cup of tea. And I really do identify with this one. I am incredibly picky about how people make cups of tea, to the extent that I tend to ask them for the cup of hot water and the tea bag separately so I can do it myself. So I'm definitely in that little quota of people. But I think it's unsurprising. And I think if you went abroad and said, what's one of the things you identify with Britain, it probably would be cups of tea.
Yeah, no, I talk about that. And I have my own specific way of making tea. Good. All right. So I'm in good company there. Number five, I'm less.
Yeah. Number five is the football results at 41%. So we do know it's a massive game in this country. We don't all follow it. I must admit, I'm not a football fan. But still, it's up there as being one of the things that people obsess over. And I, as somebody who's sort of studied football crowds and football fans, I must say it's definitely obsession, if not a religion, among some people.
All right. Interesting. Now, well, I was looking at some of the others on the list, and in fact, I went down the bottom. It was the bottom one, admittedly, but I saw this and I thought the group of people that were asked this must have been slewed towards taxi drivers or something. Number 30 is cyclists. Who on earth gossips or obsesses about cyclists other than taxi drivers
I can say one person who does. Anyone who lives in Oxford is full of cyclists because all the students get around on bikes, so it's not necessarily a negative thing, but certainly cyclists are a thing that obsess people who live in Oxford, definitely.
Massive
packs of them.
Now I was thinking this through, so you're as an evolutionary anthropologist, how quickly does this list change? Because, you know, that's evolution. Does this change over time?
This is one of the really striking things. Obviously, evolution is mostly pretty slow. And actually, the thing about this top 30 list is, whilst there are a few new additions related to technology, such as, you know, watching the telly or whatever, something like that, you could probably look 100 years ago, and a lot of these, particularly the top five, were probably still what we talked about. And that's what's interesting about these obsessions, because actually they're a real marker of nationality and membership. And from a sort of evolutionary anthropology, sort of social side and social connection side, they're really important because they help people to identify with where they come from. They're quite a comfort to know you could go anywhere in the world, meet someone else who's a Brit, and you could probably pick one of these and have a really good conversation about it. So it's actually quite a bonding thing to have these shared obsessions, interests. Some of them, you know, verge on traditions and rituals, particularly, you know, the ritual of making the correct cup of tea or the ritual of having Sunday lunch, which is on there as well. So actually they're really important, even though this is like a fun survey, they're actually very, very important to membership, feeling like you belong to a community.
Have you looked at equivalent lists across the pond, you know, in other places in Europe? You know, you know what the top five are in France?
I don't, I'm afraid. This is very much a British survey because it's done by a British brand. So it's very much a British survey. I do know that I think most people, I think we got a figure of 87% of people we asked said they think probably if other people from other countries looked at this list, they would think they're slightly quirky obsessions, which definitely mark us out as being an individual society, I think.
I like to think of myself as rather quirky, rather odd. So if that's the same, you know, if that is the UK trait, then all well and good.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it's a good thing to be.
Something that doesn't appear in this list, or perhaps it does kind of via it, social media. Now, because of social media, do we actually talk enough? Do we go down the pub and sit with each other and just look at our phones? Is talk dead?
Talk isn't dead. I would very much say it's not. What I would say, though, yes, social media has impacted the way we communicate with each other and the way we maintain our relationships. And it's not, social media has some pluses. It absolutely does. I'm not somebody who thinks it's an entirely negative thing, but it certainly has had quite a negative effect on the rate with which we see people and actually see people properly in person and the way we try to maintain our relationships. You know, I've done a lot of research on this. It's one of my research areas. And certainly if you try to just simply maintain relationships at a distance rather than meeting at the pub and having a good old chat, then your relationships certainly decay much quicker. So it's much, much better to be in person because, for example, you know, this is a health podcast. And actually, we know that your relationships are the biggest factor in your mental and physical health. So it's really important to maintain a healthy social network, who you see in person on a regular basis, because then you get all the benefits of social interaction. You get all the lovely neurochemistry that comes alongside that. And that underpins your mental health, but also your physical health, because it underpins your immune system. So there's lots of research now showing how important social connectedness is. And, you know, this list of obsessions is part of that, this idea of belonging and being part of a community and having a shared language. All of that is incredibly good for your health.
I love a good gossip, I have to say. And whether it's down the pub or on the street corner or, you know, at home over a cup of tea. Is it a dying art, though? I mean, I was saying, is it alive and good? You said yes, but I'm thinking about kids. So I've got children, a 15-year-old and a 20-year-old. They do keep in contact with their friends on their phone. But the first use for a phone, as far as I'm concerned, is using it to talk to other people. They rarely do that. So I suppose this is another evolutionary question. Are our kids kind of the same as us? Are they old gossips as well, or are things changing in evolutionary terms quite fast?
They are definitely our gossips, but they gossip through a different medium. So while we would have maybe used the phone to chat to each other, they message each other. But it's very much still, if we look at the content of messages in terms of what do people most often talk about on message, it's still all about the gossip. It's all still about, did you see this person who's in this relationship with this person, or did you hear what this person said this day, today, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, it's very much still out there, but it's just a different medium of communication.
Okay. So if people are listening to this, anyone, a child or a grown up, I suppose I can call myself a grown-up. I don't always think of myself as grown-up, but there you go. And we want to contact an old friend. What would your advice be? Talk to them, pick up the phone and talk to them, or pick up the phone and send them a message. What is best for our health?
The best for your health is to talk to them. Best for your health is actually to see them in person, but certainly pick up the phone and talk to them if you can't do that. The other way, which actually might be more comfortable for this generation rather than doing that, is some sort of video call. So whilst they might not be comfortable picking up the telephone because it seems like a bit of an outdated technology, certainly video calls, you know, FaceTime, Zoom, all those sorts of things are nearly as good as meeting in person, even better than talking on the phone, because obviously you actually get to see the person as well. So yeah. I would suggest that if you can't meet someone in person, the best thing to do is do a video call.
That sounds like very good advice. Right, I've got a final question for you, which might be a bit weird. If people are sort of fascinated by this topic, because it is inherently, I think, an interesting topic, you know, how people communicate, how important communications are, etc. They'd like to learn a bit more about it, but they don't want to read the latest paper you have published because, you know, it's going to be full of long words and, you know, might be just not quite what they want to read. Something that's a bit more chatty. And a bit more digestible. I'm sure there's some, maybe you've written one of them. Maybe there's some interesting books that the public can, you know,
absolutely
find.
There are. I mean, there's in fact one behind me. So Why We Love, which is not just about romantic love, by the way, it's about lots of forms of love, including friendship love. So very much that's a popular science book. Robin Dunbar, who I work with at Oxford University, has written several really good popular science books on social connection. And certainly, you know, there's lots of stuff out there. If you go to my website or my social media presence, there's lots of really easily digestible stuff looking at social connection and health and the best ways to interact with people.
Excellent. Look, all this is interesting stuff. Anna, thank you very much for taking a few minutes to chat.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much to my guests on this week's show. They were Dr. Alan Desmond, gastroenterologist, talking about fibre and why we should eat it, why it's good for us, and Dr. Anna Machin, evolutionary anthropologist. And the topic there was what we might gossip about and our obsessions. And thank you to you for listening, and have a healthy week until next week.
The station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Dec, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle Magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Kiss me quick. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries
and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Thanks for listening to the Relax Back UK show. Join me, Mike Dilk, again next week for more fascinating interviews and chat. If you're listening to the podcast version, please subscribe, like, and share it with your family and friends. And have a healthy week. Until next week.